Today's podcast is sponsored by Howl.fm, and they have an amazing announcement if you are a fan of Andy Daly. He is back in podcast land with a new four-part miniseries called Hoot Gibson, Vegas Cowboy, and it promises to be an incredible true story of a Western hero, except most of it's fake, but you'll have to figure out which parts. So to listen to Hoot Gibson and 150 hours of other exclusive Howl miniseries, go to howl.fm/cracked to start your free one-month trial. Once again, go to howl.fm, that's howl.fm/cracked to start your free one-month trial. Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and today we're doing things a little differently. Today we're launching the first spinoff of the Cracked Podcast. As you might have picked up on by now, I'm a huge podcast fan, and I've got to say, this is one of my favorite first episodes of a podcast that I've heard just full stop ever. And the show is a comedy podcast slash book club that we'll be running through Kurt Vonnegut's books chronologically. And I guess it might help if you have read the book that they're talking about in each episode, but I wouldn't know because I didn't read the book being discussed in this first episode. And when it was over, I looked up at the clock, cartoonishly rubbed my eyes, and, you know, shook my head back and forth and went, ooga, because I couldn't believe how much time had passed. Am I overselling this? So this is our first spinoff. Every once in a while, we are going to be using the main Cracked Podcast to launch new shows that we think you'll like. And more importantly, that we just want to exist because we're fans of podcasts and something that doesn't currently exist. I think you'll like this one in particular because, first of all, it's hosted by Alex Schmidt and Michael Swaim, two of your favorites. They are the peanut butter and jelly of comedy podcasting, the Compton and Long Beach. I think you'll also like it because it's about one of the funniest, most insightful people of all time, Americans of all time. So you're going to be learning a lot of really interesting, smart, insightful stuff, whether you've read the books or not. I've never once watched one of the How Did This Get Made movies before listening to one of those shows, and that show's still a blast. But yeah, with that, let's get right into it. I'll be back at the end with some closing thoughts, I guess. Until then, enjoy episode one of my favorite new podcast. Hey there, friends. Welcome to Kurt Vonnegut, the podcast dedicated to the life, work, and ongoing things of Kurt Vonnegut, because he's the best author in the world. My name is Alex Schmidt, and I'm here with my co-host, Michael Swaim.
Hi-ho!
Hi-ho is right.
And so it goes. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for doing it. This is going to be a lot of fun.
We are thrilled, planning
on running through all of Kurt Vonnegut's work chronologically.
Also, I didn't know there was current Kurt. I thought he died, but that's good that he's alive. This is great to hear.
Is alive in our hearts. I'm very sorry to let you know that he is, in fact, deceased.
Okay.
And put
okay.
You through.
Oh, so he is dead. Oh, great way to start the podcast.
Second round of feeling like it happened.
Yeah. I actually covered his death. This was to show sincere love in my head, but people didn't read it that way. My satire and paper in college, he passed away when I was in college, and I wrote a op-ed piece called Fat Sack of Crap Finally Dies. Just like, you know, satirically saying the opposite of all my true feelings of love and admiration for Mr. Vonnegut.
Yeah. How clearly did people pick up on the satire?
Well, everyone who worked at the paper got it, and that's about it. So whatever that percentage of the student body was, my fellow comedians were like, I see what you did there. You like Kurt Vonnegut? Do you? Yeah. No one else.
Yeah, I mean, today's episode, we're going chronologically. We're going to start with Player Piano, which was Kurt Vonnegut's first novel.
Speaking of small audiences, I don't think it got out there, did it?
So we can get into the publishing history in a bit, but not a hit. Not a huge success for him. I can kind of see why, too. But also, with anything with this, I thought it would be a nice thing to get into, like, hey, Michael, why are us two doing a Kurt Vonnegut podcast?
Yeah.
When did we find out about him? Why do we like him? What's our history with the author?
Yeah. And I think people can already tell that we're still feeling out how much am I allowed to go off on a tangent? That's only somewhat related.
Yeah.
That's what I like in a podcast. It kills a lot of time while I'm getting somewhere. So, yeah. But I do think it's hilarious that we're both the biggest Von heads, as I call them, on staff. And we're like, if there's one author we wanted to we're going to tackle this. We're going to really dig into it. And the first 5 minutes, we've already been like, he's dead and his first book was a flop. I didn't really like it. So I do think, as you like, you know, when you see The Lady Killers by the Coen brothers, I was like, well, it's widely considered their worst movie. You're like, still better than 70% of movies. Like, it's still a comer. Player Piano is very much that. And I think I think I'm with you. We talked a little beforehand, and I think we're on the same page of, like, his thesis doesn't totally hold up.
No.
Or we are the people that he fears. Because it's a, spoiler alert, it's like a 1984-style dystopian novel, right?
Right, yeah.
And, well, I don't want to, like, hatch that egg before you want to get there, but his thesis is something that even in his later works, I feel like he kind of abandons or reverses. So it feels almost like his attempt to be like, I want to make a name for myself. I've written all these crappy short stories for Playboy. I want to write a novel, a real novel, like you or I might, or like the guy who wrote The Scorched Trials. Clearly is aware of the Hunger Games, right?
Yes.
Like, that led into, he didn't wake up in the middle of the night and be like, this beautiful story of children in a maze. Like, it means so much to me. I feel like Kurt was like, dystopia, classic sci-fi staple, way to go.
Yeah.
This is just going to be my 1984 Brave New World.
Big time.
Yeah. Because it really goes through the paces in a classic way of those.
One great thing about it is it's how he would do those beats a little bit. Like, it's still that
it's
formula.
It's still super Vonnegut.
It.
Yeah, you can see him, the genius that's coming.
Yeah. With Vonnegut, personal histories, like, I remember starting to work at Cracked, and I had gotten a Sirens of Titan t-shirt for myself, and I was wearing it in, like, a meeting, and you saw it, and you were like, I would love to make a movie of that.
Yeah.
Like, that's just a thing I would love to be doing, because I love Kurt Vonnegut, and it'd be a great thing.
And that means a lot for me, because I hate the idea of adapting things in general, but as far as I'm aware, and I'd love to be corrected if I'm wrong, there hasn't been any filmed version of it.
I don't think so.
And I've looked a little bit. It's my favorite book, hands down. The reason I'm doing this podcast. So after what, episode two? We're going chronologically, right?
Yeah, that'll be
the
next
book you're up?
Yeah.
Then I'm out.
Like, oh, boy.
You're going to hear us talking about Slaughterhouse-Five, and I'm going to be like, it was fine. I didn't rate it. I don't really care. Hey, you remember in Sirens of Titan when they're on Mercury? But seriously, like, my favorite all-time book. And yeah, I'd love to see it made into a film. I'd love to make it into a film. And when I saw that shirt, I was like, yes.
Yeah.
Is Vonnegut your favorite author of all
time? I think
so.
Yeah. My first one of his was, I was in high school and I was in, like, this independent study class. And probably the best thing I got out of the class was we had summer reading for it. But it was the good kind of summer reading where they gave us a list of like 30 books and you were just supposed to pick a couple and read any of them. And I just happened to pick Cat's Cradle. It was on the list and I was just like, okay, I'll just do that. And I think I ended up reading like 15 more Vonneguts within not that many years.
Yeah, they're like, compulsive and they're not long.
yeah, they're not long. And it like, and they all, because there's so much of him in all of them, they kind of feel like an extension of each other, even though they're separate plots and so on.
In my life, it was the first shared universe experience I had too that was so robust. Like, it set the stage for me to appreciate things like Arrested Development, just with the idea of, this is an Easter egg, like before I even had the concept of an Easter egg, like before DVDs were in my consciousness, I was aware that in media you could like, oh, that's funny, that character is just wandering through this scene in a different book.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was one of the things that, man, we got shit. My summer reading was Ishi, Last of His Tribe and a Separate Piece by John Knowles.
Yeah, that was freshman year, separate piece.
Some white kid pushing another white kid out of a tree and he breaks his arm. Who gives a shit?
Yeah,
that was I want robots. I want lasers.
God, that was like the start of my high school reading. And I was like, is it all going to be about private schools in New England?
Yes,
like,
it was. Man. Yeah, it was about a snooty private school in New England and their stupid problems.
I live in Illinois. Why are we doing this?
So what got you so firmly, can you elucidate or have you meditated on, what do you think's unique about Vonnegut that like made him one of your enduring favorite authors?
There's a few things. I think, well, one thing I just mentioned, I'm from Illinois. Like, I think in one of his things, he calls people from the Midwest, like freshwater people. I'm like, oh, what a wonderful thing. And like, I feel a lot of connection to like, oh, like Midwestern guy who went to like an upstate New York college and then went off into like trying to write the like best, shortest, sharpest things you could.
Or you're very swayed by a simple compliment.
Right. Or just you were like, flattery.
I'm a freshwater person. I love you too, Kurt Vonnegut.
Oh, stop it.
Is that good? What does that mean? What does that imply? What's the connotation that you're freshwater?
He meant it positively. It's okay. It's like that they're, right, that they're very wet. No, it's that they're just like good, solid, refreshing people.
I see. Yeah. Like if I were to drink you, I'd go,
exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I'm very drinkable.
I see.
and that it kind of combines science fiction and realistic American fiction and a few other different things all together and very succinctly. And just, I hadn't read anybody quite like that who spoke to my brain like that. It's also weird. I think, well, along with that, I think East of Eden by John Steinbeck, that might be also one of my favorite books right up there with Cats, Cradle, Something Else. Mm-hmm. But I think before I had read Vonnegut, my favorite book was probably 1984. Like, it's an odd thing that, like, it was probably one of his favorites, too.
Totally.
Like,
and he
tracks it a bit in Player Piano.
Yeah. 1984 was the first book that, like, roused my emotions to an uncomfortable degree that I wasn't aware. Like, it was the first book that made me angry and disturbed, and I was upset that I had read it, and I was, like, thinking about the government for the first time. So, yeah, I could see it making a big mark. And, yeah, and for me, it's also just what I will, in retrospect, call his Whedon-esque quality is, like, I love formalism. And I just love the English language itself, and I love fucking with media. So my favorite comic strips are the ones where they do things that could only happen because it's a comic strip and in no other media, like it couldn't be filmed, because they get an effect out of you seeing multiple panels simultaneously because they know you're going to turn the page and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Whatever. Stuff like that in every media totally gets me off. So cerebrally. So for me, the Vonnegut thing is like, he demolishes the traditional book form and doesn't care what the fuck. Like the, I'm totally paraphrasing, and I'll quote it correctly when we get to that book. And it might be Sirens of Titan, but they blend together somewhat. Yeah. But there's like a book where he says, like, at the end of one long chapter, he's like, and everything depended upon, like, is this going to happen or is this going to happen? Who knows? Nobody knows. Will it happen? And then you turn the page and chapter 28 is just the words, it did. And then you turn the page and it's the next chapter. So just stuff like that. In Breakfast of Champions, he famously, like, inserts himself in the book and is like, also, Kurt Vonnegut was there. His dick was 9 miles long. Like, that's amazing to me. And it breaks the form in a way that's Brechtian. For those who don't have the privilege of like a snooty drama education, Brechtian meaning like drawing attention, meta, like we say meta now, intentionally not taking you out of the thing because the actor sucked at that moment, but taking you out of the thing to be like, filmmaking's also interesting. Look at how this was edited. Right. Pay attention to that, and that means something. So he's not afraid to do that, and he's just so goddamn witty. A master of in the way that Twain was, and I think Whedon is in film.
Yes.
The one-liner that is, so where Whedon might be in the universe of like playing off of coolness, like he wants you to hear that line and go, God, that guy's so cool, or that girl's so badass, they're gonna destroy. But Vonnegut will have a one sentence that makes you go like, that's the greatest insight I've ever heard in my life. And he just nails it. That to me is like the quintessential Vonnegut nugget.
Yeah.
Is like wisdom, dropping science in like a short, darkly funny sentence.
Sure.
And there's a lot of those in Player Piano, actually. My girlfriend Jen and I just saw Titus Andronicus, Shakespeare's famously worst play.
Right.
And it was really, really problematic and upsetting. But I won't get into why. That's too much. That's tangents on tangents. No. But similarly, there's still good Shakespeare shit in there, right? There's still amazing lines.
Yes.
And like in this, is it too early to segue into the guts of Player Piano?
No, let's get into it. And, okay. also, I was just going to say, I can't believe I didn't, in my things of why I like Vonnegut, mention how funny he is. Because he's
of course.
And there's like, I feel like there's this through line from Mark Twain to Kurt Vonnegut onto other people, especially George Saunders, that like, it's just like everybody on that tree. I'm like, these are my people. This is great. But yeah, into the guts of it. And also, this is a show, folks, where, you know, a lot of podcasts have segments and things like that. We're just going to go ahead and say we're in a segment when we're in a segment. Because it's fun and that's how life is.
Okay, we're on some kind of psychic level connection shit right now. Because I was about to try and start the first segment.
First segment.
Kurt Blurt. That's what I'm calling it, Kurt Blurt.
Kurt Blurt.
I don't know if I ran that by you.
Yeah, but you
this
did.
Is a
great.
Okay, I'm proposing a segment. This will be the first and possibly last iteration of it called Kurt Blurt.
Segment accepted.
Great. And that could be Kurt with a C or Kurt with a K. That's what's great about audio, because obviously it's something Kurt blurted, in his mind at least, before he typed it. But furthermore, I think as we're talking about, one of his trademarks is the Kurt saying, the sort of like succinct, right. Boom, gotcha. So a couple Kurt blurts, and I think this is more than anything to get people to be like, oh, I do want to read this book, because so far we've just been like, it's like an okay 1984 knockoff.
Yeah. Well, and also probably toward the top of it, we should say that this may spoil aspects of the book for you if you haven't read it yet.
Yeah.
Also,
consider this a book club. Yeah. Like, you should have read the book or not care.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And because this book, I could see you either having read and wanting to tune in, or you're like, I love Kurt Vonnegut, but maybe I'm not going to dive that deep into it and just make this my experience.
You'll get a nice smear of Player Piano. Let's do Kurt Blurt, and then we'll talk about the thesis of the book.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah.
Kurt Blurt, or like the setup of the book.
Yeah.
But I got two Kurt Blurts just to whet your appetite.
Right.
There's a checker-playing robot called Checker Charlie.
Yes.
And the book is, I'll have to at least tip the thesis a little, it's about the horrors of automation. Because God forbid if a computer could ever play checkers.
Right.
How cheap human life has become. So,
right. Like, where 1984 is terrified of totalitarian government, this is terrified of automation and robots.
Like, what if you're the guy who's really good at checkers, and then there's just some fucking computer? It's better than you at checkers?
Right.
It's dehumanizing.
In our era of more tabletop gaming than ever before,
exactly.
You've chosen checkers as your calling.
Yeah. So our hero, in quotes, Dr. Paul Proteus, is constantly winning at checkers. So someone to like prank him creates a robot to beat him at checkers. And I think it's a testament to Vonnegut's writing that it really got me. Like, I was humiliated and I felt his shame and I was really upset on his behalf.
Yeah.
When this smug idiot who would never beat him at checkers is like, I'll bet you $1,000, and then wheels out this machine, and you're like, oh, I see what's going to happen. You're going to humiliate me in front of a bunch of people by showing that even I can be automated, and it's all bullshit.
Also, all of his friends are on board with the robot.
Yes,
all of his friends are like, yeah, get him.
Let's watch this. This is going to be an amazing novelty. Yeah. Well, anyway, he wins just because the robot breaks down because it was built poorly. Like, it has a loose connection. And the guy who challenged him, whose dad spent many years of his life working on this checkers playing robot, because that's what you do in Kurt Vonnegut land, because they didn't invent Call of Duty, says, you know, why, God? Why did this have to happen? It's like Cameron and Ferris Bueller. Like, he's really petrified about how his dad's going to react. Why did this have to happen? And the Kurt blurt is, it was one more hollow echo of the question humanity had been asking for millenniums. The question men were born to ask. And I like that one.
Yeah.
And then skipping way ahead to the end, but without spoiling anything, there's another one that needs much less setup. Sort of the subversive character, Ed Finnerty, is talking about like, basically the idea of just one day saying fuck it and like bucking the system. Like, if you decided today's the day I no longer abide by law or like the American government or wherever you live. There was enchantment in what Finnerty had done. A thing almost as inconceivable and beautifully simple as suicide.
Ooh.
Not, I don't endorse like the message.
No, I'm oohing
but
to
what
the,
a,
oh,
right?
Nicely done.
Such insight and what a good Kurtism. That's like, okay, maybe this is too personal of a window to have opened up, but everyone has, I think. At the times in my life, I've contemplated suicide, seriously.
Uh-huh.
Not frequent or recent.
But, right, okay, good.
But, yeah. I don't know, that just strikes so to that moment. inconceivable and beautifully simple. Like, inconceivable is the word that I think elevated that sentence to like, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Because like the embracing death to get out of situation is at the same time such an easy out that is the most difficult decision you could ever theoretically make at the, you know, in your life.
Right.
Or like the most life altering decision.
That's getting back to one of the great things about this, like we were saying, like it's in a lot of ways templated after a 1984 or a Brave New World, or there's a novel called Darkness at Noon that
I don't know that one.
That Kervan got. It's about life in the USSR and essentially just someone's living there and then suddenly it's this horrible communist place. But that was another novel that he, according to his letters and things, was reading at the time and was saying like, oh, if I could do something.
Was
like
it like a historical though? Like
I
it was
don't remember.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did it have lasers and robots, or was it depicting what it was like to live in Russia as the communist rose if you weren't on that side?
I believe it was actually realistic. Like it was actually kind of how things were. Yeah. And either a fictionalized account or a real thing.
Because dystopias have existed on Earth. So it was like a story of one of those real ones. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think
boring.
the novel is template of a lot of those things, but then things that Kurt does in a lot of his work, like thinking about suicide is a major thing, because that comes up in a lot of his books.
Oh,
and in
he's
his life.
Dark and bitter and so funny at the same time, and that's what's amazing.
Yeah, and one of the best things about this book is that it's still Vonnegut, even though it is not that. But then also, like, talking about finding a Kurt Blurt type thing in it, like, so many of the famous ones are Hi-Ho, So It Goes, and like things like that. And this is,
the first instance of Hi-Ho, I believe, first recorded Hi-Ho, which is in this book, and it'll come up in almost every book he writes. Someone says Hi-Ho.
Oh.
I've never figured out why or what the hell that's supposed to mean.
It comes up. I forgot it comes up in this one.
Someone says it one time. I don't remember when or the context,
but I made
a big note of it. No.
Yeah.
Just like someone's like Anita's like, I don't love you and I never have. And he's like, Hi-Ho. Something like that.
Well, you know.
Anita is his problematic, frigid, manipulative, shallow, soft-headed wife.
Yeah.
We'll get into that a little later, probably. Yeah. I have problems with her portrayal.
Yeah, me too. Well, I was going to say that this book is a lot wordier than he usually is. Like, it's denser and it's less
more literate.
Tight. And it's a little bit more of a conventional book and how things are phrased and how the action happens than...
But then in the like excess packing material, if you dig it away, all the bones are still really solid Kurt Vonnegut lines. But yeah, I think he just hasn't embraced his voice yet fully. You see him trying to be a little more conventional. But there's great seeds of Vonnegut stuff, like the military guy, instead of saying forward march, saying forward harch. And there's like many of those. And I'm just thinking of the chapter in Sirens of Titan called Cheers in the Wirehouse, which is supposed to be a guy saying chairs in the warehouse. And Kurt Vonnegut just super loves writing in dialect, which is another trademark of the Coen brothers, my other like favorite artist soulmate people, just super obsessed with writing in the way a unique group of people sounds when they talk.
Yeah.
And I just love that. It makes me think of young Kurt serving in the military, listening to a guy go like, "What hurt?" And like writing down like, F-word march, Ford Harch. That's what it sounds like. Sounds like Ford Harch. That's really cool to me.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very real life thing.
Hey guys, we've got two new sponsors this week, and the first one is Movement Watches. Yes, watches, and not fancy eye watches that are really hard to control because your fingers are too big and it's hard to figure out the touchscreen thing. Movement watches are stylish, classy watches that don't cost hundreds of bucks. If you want to buy a nice watch at a department store, you're going to pay at least $400. But Movement watches start at just $95, which is less. I'm super good at math. Anyways, you've got to check out these watches because they're really cool looking. Go to mvmtwatches.com. They're just really beautifully designed. You're definitely going to think they're cool looking. And if you go to mvmtwatches.com/cracked, you'll get free shipping and 15% off your purchase. So step up your watch game at mvmtwatches.com/cracked. And the second of our two new sponsors is Indochino. If you've been to a ton of weddings lately, or you have a fancy job, unlike me, that you have to shave for and wear nice dress shirts for, you can see and feel the difference between a custom suit and a suit you just buy off the rack. Indochino makes custom suits and shirts and offers them at an incredible price. So the way it works is you go to Indochino.com or stop by one of their 9 North American showrooms. Then you pick from hundreds of fabrics and patterns and customize everything, lapels, buttons, jacket lining. From there, you just submit your measurements, and in 4 weeks, your suit arrives at your door like Cinderella's magical mice friends made it just for you. And if you're worried about measuring yourself, it's really super easy to do. There's even a video on the website that tells you exactly how to do it. Although the shirt that I got from Indochino, I got to go into their fancy store. If you have one near you, you'll feel like a fancy millionaire. They like sit you down, ask you if you want coffee, and then one of their lovely employees will like measure you up like you've seen people do in tailors at the movies. But like I said, if you can't make it into one of their stores, it's super easy to measure yourself and they show you how. And they've given us an amazing deal. This week, Crack listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for only $389 when you enter Cracked at checkout. If you haven't priced a custom-made suit in a long time, that's an amazing price. That's 50% off their regular price, and you get free shipping too. So once again, that's Indochino.com, and use Cracked at checkout to get any premium suit for $389 with free shipping.
I feel like we can get into a little bit of outlining the book in this segment called 1984.
Is that a golf four?
Yeah.
Yeah, get out it's of the like, way. Here comes dystopia.
Like I missed. Because, yeah, I feel like with this book in particular, we kind of touched on it before, but does he execute a dystopian novel with the plot he lays out?
You know? Oh, I see. We're done meandering. This is the part of the book report where the teacher's like, Mr. Schmidt, please get to the point. There are other students to get through.
The teacher and the student, and I'm the worst.
Yes.
No, but I feel like it's a good way to, the general plot of the book, if you haven't read it, or if you're trying to remember it from way back when, is the story of a scientist named Paul Proteus. Dr. Paul Proteus.
I interrupt insufferably because it's super important point, I think, is everyone in the society is a doctor of whatever they do, unless they're one of the poor people, and then they're not.
Yeah.
Like, to a ridiculous degree. Like, he goes to see whatever, his accountant, and he's like, good afternoon, doctor, and to you, doctor. And I think that kind of has come true. That satire hit home for me.
Yeah, and it's a situation where Paul Proteus is a high-ranking person at the Ilium Works in the fictional city of Ilium, New York, which is pretty clearly patterned after Schenectady, New York, in real life.
Easier to say.
And I think I said it right. And then the company is also probably patterned after General Electric's setup in Schenectady, New York. But anyway, it's a society where machines kind of determine everything. I shouldn't say kind of, they do. You take tests and your abilities are run through a computer, and it tells you either your job is to be this very high level doctor, engineer person running the machines, or you're someone who's essentially on like a WPA construction crew, like just like wandering around fixing roads and stuff.
It occurred to me, it's essentially the pilot of Futurama. Like, it's just the career chip is the plot. I mean, it's more than that because it's automation in every sense of the word. Like, their whole lives are automated. But the central conceit is, wouldn't it suck if a computer chose your job for you?
Yeah.
Or took away your job, because that's the other big thing that's happening, right, is there's this huge pool of disaffected citizens who live across the river and are, like, quietly seething away in their horrible lives because all their jobs are now done by robots.
Yeah.
And what Kurt sort of puts forward is, if you automate all the factory jobs, because they're nice to them, or, like, they give them free government subsistence, right? So it's not like they live well, or that's the point that the oppressors try to make. But there's a dignity of working, of like going to the factory and working at the lathe every day, that they somehow, the spirit has gone out of these people and they're living these drab, horrible lives. And we can get back to just like getting through the plot also, but come off it. I don't know if the factory worker working the lathe is like, this is the part of my life that imbues it with quiet human dignity, is right. working at this lathe 8 hours a day. Like, he really, like, they straight up tell a story where Paul Proteus is super pleased because he invented a technology that basically is like mocapping, which is a great sci-fi foresight. They mocap a guy who's really good at turning the lathe and building this chair leg or whatever. Right. And then they're like, now we make a robot that just perfectly mimics his motions. So now that robot makes all the lathe legs. You're all fired. And they're all like, what will we do without our lathe-making job? You've taken away the thing that made us human. And I just don't agree that that's what made them human.
I don't know if it's just like we're in a tough time in the country or something, but like it is hard to sell a dystopia where in this book, everyone is fed and everyone has a house and everyone... Right. Like,
but
there's
the idea
no
that
property,
automation does your job is what's sad or what we're supposed to be upset
the
about.
The thing that's been taken away is that early in the book, they... And it's like really laying out exactly what it's about very early where they talk about like, oh, the first industrial revolution was the one that happened
that
where we got factories. And then the second industrial revolution is robots replaced like routine work done by humans. Yeah. And they talk about like what happens when the third industrial revolution replaces being a smart person, essentially, or like a white collar, high level like manager of things.
Yeah, and he has a quote that's supposed to like be one of the doom moments. Yeah. And keep in mind, okay, so like Brave New World is about the question of, first of all, there are losers in those societies. Like in Brave New World, they're thoroughly oppressed groups of society who are suffering horribly.
Right.
And it's about the idea of if you could take a drug every day that just makes you happy regardless of whether your house is going to shit or not. And that's very interesting to me. Are you living a happy life or are you living a lie that's just weird drug addiction? Right. That's Brave New World. And then 1984 is explicitly like everyone except the ruling class think they're doing all right because of propaganda, but they're actually living like poverty stricken. Right. Like all they drink is cheap gin and go to their shitty jobs and eat a piece of bread.
Yeah.
In Player Piano, the stakes seem so much lower because everyone is explicitly doing fine. It's funny because Vonnegut has this mix of optimism that most sci-fi writers have and intense pessimism about progress.
Right.
Where he's like, he envisions machines doing a great job so everyone does have enough to eat and a lot of great shows on TV to watch and like can learn whatever they want from the Automo book or school or whatever. They don't go into full detail, but it seems like their only real gripe is that there's nothing for them to do. Like, they're bored.
Yeah.
If you're living in a thing where that you think is a utopia, as the people in charge try to assert, yet the place where you work, the Ilium Works, is guarded by an inner gate, an outer gate, and multiple armed guards in a cement bunker with a little slit in it, how do you not know you're actually in a dystopia?
Yeah.
It's so clear.
And they also say that the laws of the country have been changed. So if you're a saboteur, if you're a person who's breaking these machines, that's like the worst crime you can commit.
I love that. It's like the ultimate opposite of Asimov, where, at least the robot's main rule is don't fuck with humans. But law is humans can't break a robot. That's the ultimate crime.
And from there, the book kind of unspools a thing of, is Paul going to decide that this dystopia that he's sitting behind all the fences of, is he going to decide to buck the trend of it, or is he going to be like his father before him who helped build this and like continue to run it and manage it and rise up in it? And at the same time, will he be okay with his relationship with his like implausibly Lady Macbethy almost wife? And
Have you seen A Simple Plan?
No.
Really, really good movie. I'm also just going to shoehorn in as many recommendations as I can. Simple Plan, great Sam Raimi movie. Underseen, I would say. But it really reminded me, there's a scene where the wife, basically these guys find $1 million in the woods and they just decide not to return it. They don't know anything about it. But slowly but surely they turn on each other until they're all dead and no one got the money. You know, it's like that kind of story. And the guy you're supposed to hope might at the last second do the right thing or get out of the situation has this horrible wife that is like straight out of Player Piano. I mean, it's Anita. It was amazing. Because in Player Piano, there's this scene where Paul's the character that we're with where we can't decide, is it good that society's like this or is it bad? And of course, like in all these books, secretly there's a revolution brewing. And is he going to join the revolution? Is he going to stick with the imperialists, or is he going to just be torn up in the middle? That's sort of the question of the book. And yeah, his wife, just like in A Simple Plan, is super pro oppressors and manipulative and like heartbreakingly so. You know, he loves her and wants her to be enlightened with him, or his version of what he wants her to believe. So like the great symbol of that is in like the halfway mark of the book, he buys a farm, right? And it's a farm that explicitly has laws on it, for boring reasons that don't matter, where it can't be automated. It's like a national curiosity of the state. Like,
It's like somebody's will, and it's historically marked, and like and so on and so forth.
And he thinks that this will get her. He's still in the middle of the book. He's not going to join the revolution and like die, but he might just run away from here and take his wife to a farm and just live on a farm. And I love that, first of all, he takes her there on what he wants to be a very impressive romantic date.
Yeah.
They drink heavily. They pre-party before they go there.
Yeah.
They're driven there, which, by the way, I don't know why Kurt Vonnegut could imagine everything being automated, but there are still barbers and drivers. Automatic cars are not possible in his mind.
Well, it's even like,
nor
it even
is a haircutting machine.
But even makes it a little less dystopian, because the barber's like, people thought it was too weird if it was a robot, so I do it still. It's like, okay, then I guess things are a little better though.
Oh yeah. You know? But then there's the negative example of that when they're all having dinner right before the Checkers Charlie debacle, when is the only, I believe, the only minority outside the Shah and his entourage in the book.
Yeah.
"Dinner is served," said a Filipino waiter. "Many had talked about replacing the waiters with robots, but this was always voted down in a landslide." I'm like, I love, like, the implication is that, no. I still want to feel superior to a fellow race of humans when I eat my bullshit. You can automate everything else, but that little feeling of exclusivity, let's keep that. But yeah, what was I talking about? Oh, so he's trying to impress his wife and get her to move to a farm. They pre-party before they get there, and their romantic dinner includes 2 glasses of whole milk fresh from the cow's udder and a bottle of gin. Milk and gin.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, she's perfect terrible. Life. So they know. So they go to bed that night, and he basically spills his guts, right, and tells her the truth, which is that he's disillusioned. He wants to drop out of this bullshit society.
Yeah, and she like kind of refuses to accept it and keeps pushing him to stay in it. And then he keeps getting pushed by the company to be higher and higher in society, and then at the same time keeps kind of trying to avoid it. He knows a guy who's like very careerist and trying to replace him, and he's kind of like, great, go ahead,
Shepherd,
but also can't do that.
Yeah.
Lawson Shepherd. And then it builds and builds to a climax of him deciding kind of to revolt, but then also it getting turned on him by the people above him, who are like, great, what a cover, a revolt, very funny.
And
very
I
good
super want to heavily get into that, but in the interest of somewhat keeping it chronological, I just want to unpack the farm thing a little bit. So they go to bed that night, right? And she has that thing where she whispers in his ear, just like Lady Macbeth, or just like Simple Plan Lady. I'm like, who's going to win? Blue team, by God. Blue team's going to win. Which is very much, I think, in this book, Vonnegut's version of, and he loved Big Brother. It's moment where, I mean, Paul ends up going back and forth and back and forth and back again. But it's one of the moments where he's like, I give up. I'll join the shitty society.
Yeah.
And it's worse than her just not wanting to live there. She wants to automate the farmhouse, remember? The reason he's disappointed is he takes her to live in this farmhouse, and she's like, I love it. And you really think the book might turn into, oh, it's going to be us, them against the world. Like, he's going to flip her.
Yeah.
And she's like, I love it. We can replace that with an automatic blah, blah, blah. We can insert the automatic thing over there. And he's like, oh, my heart is broken. So maybe we should get into how he's courted by Ed Finnerty and the ghost shirt.
Yeah.
Folks, right. So talk a little bit about the revolution.
There's like a revolutionary group against this company and the way society works called the Ghost Shirt Society. It's named after the Ghost Dancers, which were a Native American movement against sort of the destruction of Native American culture. And it's also, there's an interesting thing where in Kurt's life, as he was doing this novel, he was working on getting his master's degree at the University of Chicago in cultural anthropology. And he submitted a thesis where he was going to, or at least his original thesis was going to be about the Ghost Dancers. It was going to be about that actual movement. And his thesis idea was rejected completely. But in doing all that research, it influenced that being a part of the book.
Yeah, and that's another thing I love about this is I don't know any of the real life stuff, and it turns out all these books, no matter how imaginative, are like super autobiographical.
Yeah.
So the way this company is sort of super smarmy and into like the nobility of the corporate culture seems like straight up he hated working at GE, or he at least observed this train of thought that he thought was destructive and then exaggerated it for effect. But when his wife's saying who's going to win, and he's saying blue team by God, it's because against his will, he's been made the leader of the blue team at this yearly, basically team building retreat.
Yeah.
That, can you talk about that? Like there was a real GE equivalent?
In the book, it's called The Meadows, after the location where they have four color-coded teams of like the high-rising people in this fictional version of GE. They like do this team-building thing there with a lot of just running around all day doing physical activities and networking and like cocktails at night. And that's how you prove you're like a person in the company. And there are even like team songs for it. All those elements are in an exact thing called Camp GE. That people in General Electric did, and that people who worked with Kurt's brother, Bernard, who also worked at General Electric and was older and a scientist there, like people who worked with him also
went there.
Yeah, so he was on a team. There's this book called The Brothers Vonnegut by Ginger Strand that gets into Kurt Vonnegut and his brother and their overall experience at GE and all those different things. And it's like beat for beat. He even like got out of his day job at GE to write this novel basically about GE. Like it really guided the whole thing. And his brother was part of a team with a scientist named Irving Langmuir, who was one of, I think, the first or one of the first in like industrial scientists to win a Nobel Prize. And then another guy named Vincent Schaefer, I think it was. But the three of them were working on cloud seeding. And then Kurt's brother, Bernard, came up with silver iodide as the chemical you use to do it. So
to make it
of,
rain, essentially.
Yeah, because they started using
the phrase. Yeah, it's how we artificially can make it rain.
Yeah, yeah. And because they started using dry ice and it did fine, but it kind of wore off. And then Bernard found out that silver iodide makes the effect last and you can create like floods and like crazy, just crazy weather phenomena for long periods
bizarre.
Of time.
Yeah. I don't even know, because I heard about that we have that technology to make clouds rain.
Yeah.
Do we do that? Are people out there doing that regularly? I'm not aware of, like, I never give a buzz on my phone that's like, hey, it's going to rain over your area because we're seeding the clouds because you need water.
Well, it was a thing that as soon as they were coming up with it, they realized like, oh, someone should regulate this because
my
like,
God, what are we? And that might, that's partially the inspiration for Ice Nine and Cat's Cradle, right?
Yeah, well, so also Player Piano was Kurt's first novel, but it was not his first attempt. And his first attempt
like,
was
not
to
the
do...
first outline he thought of.
Yeah, yeah. And his first attempt was based on conversations with GE scientists who said, like, hey, if you like restructured ice the way ice works, you would have this whole different composition. And so he came up with Ice Nine and was like, why don't I write a novel around Ice Nine? And he kept outlining it and he kept trying and it kept not working. And then after he wrote a couple novels and 10 years went by, he finally turned it into Cat's Cradle. But nice. His first idea was, oh, these GE people have inspired me to do.
So it's obviously autobiographical, Player Piano, I mean, more so than the rest. And I wonder, did you have anyone in there that you thought was the Vonnegut surrogate? Meaning like just saying the things. At some different points, I thought it could be Finnerty, who's the guy who sort of comes into the story already ready, eager to join the revolutionaries, but who came from Paul's background. Or it could be Lasher, who's the reverend who grew up in sort of the subjugated part of town. So he's like the leader of the revolt who's of those people.
So I think he's spread throughout the book.
Or his brain could be split up, yeah.
Well, because this is a great time for a segment called Kurt Cameo!
Kurt Cameo!
Because obviously, if you read Lochervine, you know, many of his books, he just writes Kurt Vonnegut into it. He actually shows up. Mm-hmm. Or Kilgore Trout
by
is
name,
the person
yeah.
who's him, or something like that. This one, I think a few elements of him are spread out throughout it. Lasher is definitely one of them, especially because he goes around saying, like, oh, I'm a priest, but also I'm interested in how cultures work and so on and so forth. And that kind of fits with a lot of Kurt's interests and so on. There's also a thing in Kurt's real life where when he got hired to work in the PR office at GE through his brother, the scientist, kind of helping him get the gig, he didn't have a college degree yet. He had left Cornell to go fight in the war, and then he hadn't gotten his thesis yet at U of Chicago, so he didn't actually have a degree. And when we're talking about the outline of this book, there's the main story following Paul, but there's also a sort of B story, I guess. They're constantly following a fictional leader of a country called Bratpur, like the Shah of Bratpur. And he's visiting the United States to see what it's like. And you kind of see how their society works through him. And the guy leading him around is a guy named Ewing Halyard, who later in the book you find out he is going to lose his whole life because he didn't pass one gym class in college, which he needed the degree to get his doctorate, and then from there his whole life. And so if he doesn't go back to college and pass a gym class, he loses everything.
It's like Brazil, like that terror of... It's a different side of the coin, I think, of the horrors of automation, where it's like... Or even the trial, you know, it's like, oh, this one clerical error destroys your life, and because the system's so bureaucratic and cold, no one cares and no one's going to help you.
Yeah,
but like, we forgot to hit the space bar 20 years ago, so you're fired. Sorry.
Right.
Yeah, that's his situation. It is such a, didn't you think though, kind of a tangentially related plot? Like, it barely touches on the A plot at all.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's just kind of a way for the Shah of Bratpur to represent, here's what someone from outside the society might think of it.
Yeah, it's sort of when Kurt signed up for the job at GE, they hired him on the condition of him finishing his thesis, and he was like, oh, yeah, I'll finish it. But he didn't for a long time. Like, he was shooting
back to school instead.
Right. Right. And so he, throughout his time at his job, he just knew, like, if anybody finds out I don't have that degree, they're just going to summarily fire me, and my wife and child won't have food, and what do I do?
See, so that's what I mean. Like, I feel like it's less defensible to have that B-plot in there, but he was like... emotionally invested in Halyard's story because it was autobiographical.
Yeah.
Which is funny because I don't think Halyard's even that sympathetic. Did you like him?
No, not in particular.
He totally is just like a representative of someone who totally buys the societal rules they were raised in and is going to go along with it, right?
Like, yeah, and then just gets squished by him at the end.
And gets destroyed by the revolution.
Well, and also in the original drafts of the novel, the way it ends and how it came out, it ends with Paul, but in the original drafts of the novel, there was an extra final chapter with Halyard and the Shah, and so it sort of landed on them more, and it sort of, but they got rid of that, but didn't get rid of the whole thing. And so it sort of feels like it's just kind of there, yeah. And then also the one other autobiographical thing is there's a weird part in that Shah Halyard thing where they pick up the Shah of prostitute
super
in town.
Out of left field. By the way, the only female character other than the evil wife is a prostitute.
Yeah, and like kind of a dopey secretary.
Yeah.
Like
just I forgot Catherine. Out. Oh, yeah. One of my favorite lines also. And I'll save this for a little segment because I got a lot of ammunition for a segment you know we're going to get to. But I'll throw one out right off the bat is the line, Catherine began to cry then, so he slipped into his office and shut the door. Yep, classic 1940s response.
Broads. Whoop. Okay. Yeah,
I'm just gonna. Okay, hold my calls.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and with the prostitute, it's really jarring at all that they're doing it. But then she gets in the limo and they're driving the Shah around in, and Halyard's like, you know, he like wants to use you as a prostitute, right? And the lady's like, yeah, I know. This is what happened in my life. My husband tried to write a novel, and the novel didn't pass like the computer system for what a good novel is.
Vert Conabit.
Right. and she's like, yeah, and the computer said his novel wasn't quite good enough, so now we have no food or anything, and I need to feed our family somehow. So it's like this really weird, bizarre moment where Kurt writes in his terror about the failure of his novel in his novel.
Yeah.
In a novel that also kind of ended up failing.
And here's my question for you, dead Kurt. bear with me. So one of the things I found hard to believe, or that made me think that the evil society in this dystopian novel is kind of a straw man argument.
Yeah.
First of all, we'll get to it, but the point of his very famous short story, Harrison Bergeron, is the opposite of this. But anyway, that aside, if you're just taking this world on its own merits, they've put these machines, and we're talking about what Vonnegut writing in the 30s? Or 40s.
He wrote this mostly in 1951, this book.
I'm way off.
No, it's okay.
So that's why you're here, for the grounded. Okay, so this is the 50s idea of the horror that computers could one day become.
Yeah.
So what's funny to me is it has Jetson syndrome. Like, this computer that's all powerful, in his imagination in this book, it's still the size of like 6 buildings.
Right.
Unnecessarily. It still runs on punch cards and vacuum tubes.
Yeah.
It just processes like a billion punch cards a minute or something. And what's more, it can do some things, you know, as sci-fis want to be. This amazing hypothetical computer can do lots of things our computers still can't do, but it can't do very simple things that our computers can easily do now.
Right.
So it's a total crapshoot of, like, what this guy in the 50s thought computers might end up being like.
And also, this is a good spot for a very tiny recurring characters segment. Recurring characters. Because,
which character?
It's kind of sneaky, but the big super uper computer that they just take a chapter with, Epicac, is in also another short story and a few other spots. And so it's sort of a sneaky one because that's a computer.
Do you think it was meant to sound like Ipecac, the solution you take to induce vomiting?
I think almost definitely, yeah.
Okay, because, yeah.
It's sort of a parody of ENIAC for you people who love punny versions of mainframe games.
Exactly. But I do think, do you know the HAL IBM thing?
Is that, letter off,
right? In 2001, A Space Odyssey, the computer is called HAL because it's one letter off of IBM.
Yeah, so it's
supposed to just be an IBM.
Right.
That's the one that fucks up and kills everyone, not a Mac. But so I would just say at Kurt, I find it hard to believe that a society would have a computer that clearly the computers, because he explicitly says, they don't understand things like randomness or like what the Japanese call wabi-sabi, like the beauty of asymmetry, the value of creativity, like the power of random mutations, either literally in DNA or like in ideas, to make a bunch of garbage, but also sometimes create something amazing that wouldn't have existed otherwise. So like diversity and variety and chaos, we all know, I feel like, is a strength. Yeah. I mean, we live in a country of immigration historically, and I think that's part of that belief is like, get a lot of ideas in the mix. Anyway, I just find it hard to believe that the society would turn everything over to machines before they were ready. And here's my counterexample. If the machine was right, like if that machine read his book, the character that had the failed novel, and was like, this won't sell. The machine's either right or wrong, right?
Yeah.
And if it's wrong, then I find it hard to believe that we ever would have gotten in this position. Because if there's a book that would have sold 1 million copies, but it didn't get published because a machine said no, people who could have made money on that book will be really pissed off. And it would, like, I feel like that system wouldn't develop just because the money incentive. And then on the other hand, if the machine's right, then all it did was save the author time. The time and pain of releasing their book, seeing it make no money and bomb, and then still being in the same position where your wife is prostituting herself to the Shah because you're broke. So I guess all I'm saying is, like, hail our glorious robot leaders. I don't see the problem. Yeah.
Well, I think
he picked a wrong problem for this dystopia.
And that question you asked before about, like, is this a dystopia or is this, like, already kind of happening to us and so on?
Oh,
like,
yeah. And a lot of it. That's what's more impressive is not the stuff he predicted would go wrong in horrible, dark ways hasn't, but a bunch of the stuff he just predicted would be true is.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, there's one bit where they talk about, like, I think he's seeing a doctor or something, and it's like, yeah, robots handle a lot of this now. Like, that's happening. Like, people are working on a robot that knocks out the paperwork and the initial checking in on a patient for their temperature and so on and things like that.
Yeah.
We're working on that right now. And even with, like, creative work, like, you read things about, oh, Netflix looked at their algorithm and that was a guidepost they used to develop House of Cards. They were like, yeah, people like Kevin Spacey and people like political dramas and some of that. That's very good to know.
Yeah.
Humans go write it, but, like, we'll use the aid of robots to help us with this kind of thing.
Man, there's an amazing comic book called Scud the Disposable Assassin.
I've heard of it. I haven't read it.
One of the issues is about a futuristic alien society where the countries only battle, like in war, by whoever can bankrupt the other side by sending the best, most kick-ass AAA action movies that everyone goes to and, like, spends all their money on until your society's bankrupt. So they have these advanced computers that just spend their time calculating, like, 9 explosions per minute is the optimal number of explosions. It's really cool.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, and I guess I wouldn't have a problem with that is what I'm learning about myself.
When we even, like, just calculating what we need in general, like, companies like Amazon kind of do that.
Yeah, because, like, that's the other big point of the book, like, is Ipecac is constantly saying, only make 18,408 microwaves. That's how many you'll need.
Yeah.
No reason to denude nature by taking more resources. That's how many people will buy this year.
Yeah.
And that sounds great. And we're doing that.
Right. And the book says, like, that's the main reason their society has enough food and everything is right. That they've had computers figure out how to not waste resources.
How to conserve
resources.
The food.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, great.
That sounds great. But then everyone's sort of just, and trust me, I think it's interesting. We're kind of getting bearing on like a political issue, which is I get the counter side in real life, which is I'm only trained to do this job. Automation took it away. No one's giving me any training or money in recompense. The rest of my life is going to be a spiral down into poverty. And that freaking sucks. And we should do more to help people who are put out of a job. But I guess I just can't agree with the idea that you have to like freeze it or somehow retard the progress, because I truly believe that there are amazing, noble things to do in life. Like if you were born into a future civilization where you didn't ever have to worry about food or anything like that, or finding housing or anything. I don't want my job dictated to me. But I mean, let's say you had no job because you lived in like Starfleet Academy.
Yeah, technological and they replicated unemployment. Yeah.
I'm sort of on the Gene Roddenberry side where I feel like, of course, there would still be crazy murderers and assholes, a percentage. But if we lived in a resource-free society, I don't think people would just become like filled with malaise and shitty and just like mill around doing nothing, living in a haunted, horrified state. I think we would like, everyone would be super into like art, philosophy, like just hanging out and talking with your family. Like there's lots of good stuff to do with your life. You don't have to work. The reason to work is to earn your keep, right? But I'm just saying if in theory, no one's being oppressed by you just chilling. Chilling is fun. I don't see why what the problem is with that.
Well, and maybe one of the successfully predictive things about the book is that at the end of the book, everyone is like, oh, bring back the machine. Like, I loved machines. Let's just get that going again.
Yes. And we should get to the end. Yeah. Okay. So two things. I'm sure you notice like multiple people when he's driving around say, hey, your headlight's broken.
Yeah.
And I think it finally clicked for me that I think it's supposed to be like, just hammering home that he's the character who sees both sides and isn't sure which way he's going to go.
Yeah.
Like Finnerty has the vision, the true vision of what is going down right now in society. He sees through the bullshit.
Right.
But Paul's like, well, I see one eye's open, one eye's closed, sort of because I want it to be, because I'm not ready to risk it all.
And then people like his superiors like Kroner and Bear and so on just like love it. They're on the opposite of Finnerty.
Right.
They're like, no, this is the best. And let's never change it.
And I love that he also slips in. He sort of slips in someone who represents every sort of response. Like Luke Lubbock is this rando character who they see who is a member of like the equivalent of like the Masons and the Moose Lodge. But then later you see he's also a member of the Secret Rebellion.
Yeah.
Then at the Meadows, when they're doing the stupid GE propaganda chant, they mention that he's there just because he's on the wait staff, but he has like his hand to his heart and is crying and openly like cheering along to all the propaganda. The point being that there are people who just like joining organizations.
Yeah.
And I love, he's a minor character and they are a minority in society, but I love that he presented like, there's also people who are going to join whatever revolution is going on. Like the Luke Lubbocks, who are just moved by anything that pretends to be noble.
And also just
like,
love,
they're going to fall for anything. Whoever talked to them most recently.
Yeah. And they also just love being in groups. Like it's almost kind of a predictor of the Grand Falloon concept of like, oh, a group has power just mentally for us because we're part of a thing. And that's very exciting.
Savonikit, I think we're going to hit on this probably throughout the whole podcast. He has that famous quote. I think it's from Mother Night, but I'm not sure. We become what we pretend to be. So we must be careful what we pretend to be.
Yeah.
Mother Night.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's about a guy pretending to be a Nazi. But I believe that that is like the central point of Vonnegut's life. One of maybe two. The other one being like people should be courteous, which has a lot more power and wisdom in it than you think at first. But man, that quote, there's so many proto versions of that quote in here. Like his thing is about pretension and perception. So just a quick rundown. After this Luke Lubbock thing happens, Reverend Lasher, who represents the revolution and all it stands for, says, you know, I got to get a uniform so I'll know what I represent. And Paul says, or two, like Luke. And Lasher says, all right, okay, fine, two. But that's the most any human being should allow themselves, like any self-respecting human being. And it just really reminded me of how, like, I have an alone self. And the only major difference is that I'm, like, more of a slob without, you know, like, no one watching me.
Yeah.
And then I have, like, myself that's engaged and ready to be an active listener and, like, interrupt way too much and present to, like, people around me. But that's like the most you should have. If you have a third, then you obviously have some kind of secret life going on.
Right, right.
But also just the idea of using your outer self to represent. So he also says, Anita asks if Ed had a good time at the party. He says he did, or at least he believes he did, and that's the same thing. Check how many of these quotes are basically, we must be careful what we pretend to be. Yeah. About Shepard, the guy who represents the person who's just aggressively using the system. The world Shepard lived in was a hard one, but he wouldn't have it any other way. So again, his perception is everything. About Lasher, yesterday's snow job becomes today's sermon.
Which is almost like a Bocanonist kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like almost like, oh, these good fake things.
Yeah. Harmless really lies. Yeah. And then last one, half the people or more didn't understand much about the machines they worked at, but they worked at them very well. Which I would like to think I work at these machines very well. And I don't, again, what's wrong with that? I read this on a Kindle. I don't know how this microphone works. Fuck you, Kurt Vonnegut. Society survived. Yeah. But let's get into the ending. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
There's a lot there too. I want to know your interpretation. Like, I'm not even sure what I think happened.
So Paul joins the revolution, but when he intends to join the revolution and says, I'm joining the revolution to the powers that be, they say, oh, great. Yeah. You're wink, wink, joining the revolution. Very funny. Great cover. So Paul gets himself kicked out of the job actually wants to get kicked out of.
The Ilium powers that be.
Oh, yeah.
Just for the clarity of people who haven't read. Yeah.
Sure, sure.
So the Ghost Shirt Society are the revolutionaries. Then the Ilium representatives, the Ilium works as the company men. And he's like to them, I want to quit. And they're like, yeah, great. That's exactly the character that we've scripted for you. And he's like, no, really, I want to quit. And they're like, you're going to be a really good secret agent. Listen how committed you are to the role.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But meanwhile, the Ghost Shirt Society, literally under truth serum, is like, do you really hate the way things are? And he's like, yeah, I do. And they're like, oh, he was telling the truth.
Right.
So by virtue of the fact that he's of both worlds, he can keep kicking the decision down the road.
Yeah.
Like, he still could go either way. He's legitimately in the rebellion. And if he wanted to, he could puss out and say he was a double agent and run back to the arms of the government.
Yeah. And then his wife, Anita, leaves him for Lawson Shepard, which they had all kind of set up throughout the book. And
right, because Shepard represents the ambitious one who's actually playing by the rules. She thinks those rules are great. So
they're a much
down.
Better fit for each other. Yeah. And then Paul and the Ghost Shirts, quick version is they go and break the machines, and then in the process break the machines, they break all of the machines, and they're like, no, but we can keep some of them. People are
looting,
like, no, we're not doing that.
They're like, should we keep like the automatic respirators that keep the babies alive? And they're like, wreck everything. Not that explicitly, but the implication is the looting of the revolutionaries goes way out of control,
right?
More than the leaders thought it would.
And it's still kind of a comical revolution because it only happens in a couple of cities. It happens in Ilium and I think Oakland and Salt Lake, and
most
that's it.
Of the groups and chicken then, out
yeah. yeah and most of the other
or
groups in the major
get
cities
shut down,
right? And then after they've done this, they find a group of people. There's like a broken soda machine for this soda called Orangeo that no one likes except the guy who's in charge of all production, and so that's why they're Orangeo machines. But after the people have broken
which I'm
everything,
sorry, shouldn't the computers shut that down? I thought the
Which
whole point of the system
thing, yeah.
was there was no inefficiency based on like, well, the boss likes this drink, so we have to stock it. That's the exact kind of efficiency the computers would be like, no, it's not going to sell. No one likes it.
Yeah, well, because I was thinking throughout, like, the one way this dystopia does get really, really scary is if it's Terminator and, like, the machines really do start running things, like, for themselves. But I don't think it ever...
in their own best interest?
Yeah, but I don't think it ever hits that point.
I don't
like,
even
still
think they're
people
self-aware.
In charge of, like, like punch card computers.
And I think
everything.
Vonnegut intentionally doesn't want it to be. You're not scared of the robots. You're scared of the fact that how could people do this to each other with machines?
right. And so the people, they're with this broken machine to make a soda that no one likes, but people are like tinkering with it because everybody's become like was an engineer or is naturally into engineering in the society. And they're like, oh, I can't wait to rebuild this machine. This will be so fun. And the people running the revolution realize that like, no matter how much they get people to break machines, even beyond the point of any sense, they're going to want to rebuild them and want to live this way. And so they go and turn themselves in to the authorities.
I don't want to be overtly political, but the clearest analogy for me is they go like, oh, it's not Trump, it's the voters. Here's where I blow your mind. Like, do you think Vonnegut thought they're giving up because fuck it? Or are they giving up because it's like the end of Star Wars 4 and it's the medal ceremony? I couldn't tell if I was supposed to be happy or like Big Brother horrified.
Well, I think in an earlier draft of the novel, there was like a final chapter where Paul comes back from jail after years and years and like meets Kroner back at the farm. And they talk about how...
Is he married to Hermione, finally? We flash forward.
Right. And his second son uses a time turner. Paul says he became the librarian in prison. So he read a lot and he's become more philosophical. And he's like, I hope people can hang on to their humanity and be more technological. Boy, that would be great. And so that is like, I feel like
that must be what Vonnegut thinks.
It's sort of cheating to say, oh, because of this thrown out chapter, that's what the ending means. But I feel like he's too. But also in terms of like, can he write a fully dystopian novel? I don't even know if he can. Like even in other books, when like all the world's seas are frozen and things like that, or like all humanity is mutated into like seal thingies in Galapagos, like it's still kind of chummy and heartfelt even after the world's ended.
That's the other thing about Vonnegut that I think is so unique and special is to me he's like an Eminem dichotomy. Eminem in his glory days was fascinating because he was so fucked up and such a hateful person. And then every other song would be him saying, I know, I hate myself too. And you'd be like, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And I feel like Vonnegut's interesting because every book on the surface, he goes like, everything is bullshit.
Right.
Humans are the worst. All we do. I lived through World War II. All I see is rape and murder. That's really all it is. Isn't it funny? You got to be nice to each other. Like, he's somehow also the most kind-hearted. Like,
yeah.
He very fervently believes that the world is a dark, dark place full of suffering, but he equally maintains his faith that I need to be nice and kind all the more. And he has that sliver of hope of, like, I'm still going to tell people you should be kind, because if we all did, it wouldn't be such a hellish place. So, like, you can't get me, Vonnegut. You know, you act dark, but you're not H.R. Giger. Like, you do think there's hope.
Right.
Can I call out some images?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That really got me.
This is a segment called Imagerama.
Calling them out. Finnerty, title shout out. Cracks a hard-boiled egg on the player piano in the bar.
Yeah, there's a bar in town in like the town's divided up into there's a factory and then a river and then like where everybody else lives, and there's a bar where everybody else lives that has a player piano.
Yeah. And I just love that as the image of like subverting a machine's intended use.
Oh yeah.
It's like the most minor form of sabotage that he won't get arrested for, that he can get away with publicly, is taking a machine and using it for something unrelated.
Yeah.
I also love in that same scene, he's basically saying all the cynical shit that we just said Kurt Vonnegut believes as he's drinking. And then at the end, he says, my glass is empty. So just like the old optimist pessimist thing, my glass is empty, my glass is full.
Yeah.
And then for me, the payoff that made it worth reading the book to me, well, no, there's a lot of stuff in there. But the ultimate champion in this book to me was he gets tried, right? Because Paul gets caught by the police.
Yes.
Briefly incarcerated, put on trial, and then rescued.
Rescued,
quote, unquote,
and they launched the
attack. By the revolutionaries, yeah. Right. So all Paul wants, and the reason he eventually switches over to the side of the revolutionaries, is to be not automated. He wants to be a human. He wants to be living and be not a machine, not automatic. When he's on trial, he is hooked to a lie detector of the future that's like perfect, we're led to believe.
Yeah.
So just literally all of his inner thoughts are apparent to everyone, which is just such cruel and unusual way to like have your legal system work. So he's tied up to a bunch of wires to measure all of his neural impulses. Then the revolutionaries burst in and rip him out of the thing as they're telling him that he's their messiah, and he says, this is so great, all I've ever wanted is like a thing to do, like a big thing to do with my life. They say, oh, you don't need to worry about that. We have all your speeches written. We have a really good PR plan that's going to roll out. Yeah. All you have to do is like sign your name at the bottom of all these forms. Then you're going to hide in a bunker doing absolutely nothing because we can't afford to have you die, and we'll just do everything for you. So he's automatic again. He's like the automatic messiah that's not necessary.
Yeah.
As he is being forcibly moved from one location to another with strings attached to him. And Vonnegut even describes him as looking like a marionette,
yeah,
like earlier in the section. And I just think that's dope. That was my favorite moment.
And they just needed his name. And also, like, buried Easter egg is that the last name Proteus is part of the name of a guy, Charles Proteus Steinmetz, who like founded...
See, you got all this real world shit.
Yeah, he founded the research lab at General Electric that Kurt's brother worked at, and like had great times at, because the boss of it would walk around to all the researchers and say, are you having fun today? Are you having fun today? Are you having fun today? And they would just develop anything they could. Yeah. And then it kind of shifted and got worse from there. Mm. But it's like...
Now I'm thinking maybe Ed is his brother. Roots.
I could actually, yeah, I could see that a bit. Or like they're both kind of a combination of each other.
A combination, yeah. But speaking of which, the analogous lab that Ed worked at and then gets fired from is National Research Development Laboratory, or Nerd Lab, which I just enjoyed. Did you have a favorite moment?
Well, I think you mentioned the trial, and like the trial to me is when one of the times when the book gets the most Vonnegut-y, I would say. We were talking about Kurt needed to like kind of break himself down and find his voice by making Paul a character who's on trial and feels just fully exposed and feels pinned down by this lie detector.
Also,
then he starts talking like Kurt Vonnegut in a way that I expected him to be.
And how classic of a conceit is it to be like, well, let's have a trial now so that I can have the two arguments that I'm presenting literally just go against each
other. Just directly. Yeah, it's a little blocky. And I think my... I like there's a line, the main business of humanity is to do a good job of being human beings, not to serve as appendages to machines, institutions, and systems. And that's the thing that, and it's literally a part in the trial where they're like, they're calibrating the lie detector and they tell him to lie. And he says something like, all scientific progress is good. And it's like, it says it's a lie. He thinks it. And then they're like, say something true. And he says that about people. And it's such a like basic boiled down Vonnegut.
Big tits will get you in anywhere is in there.
Oh yeah.
That's or it might be a different chapter, but it's definitely a quote in there.
Yeah. Is that with the prostitute lady? Maybe. I forget.
I don't know.
Yeah. It's a weird bit. I think it's a fascinating novel in particular, if you like Vonnegut, but also just in general to see somebody who's so, I think, fundamentally not quite dystopian going for the most hardcore 1984 thing he can do.
Yeah. And I will say the closest he got to convincing me was in that trial scene when he says, what distinguishes men from the rest of the animals is his ability to do artificial things, and a step backward after making a wrong turn is a step in the right direction. I was like, well, you're so good at words that I almost agree with you. But just the idea that there is such a thing as, you know, spiritual or social progress and technological progress. And he's just sort of saying, no one's making us pursue technological progress as hard as we can. We can do whatever we want. In fact, it's one of the amazing things about being human. We could get together and decide to change society in this way or that way. So why be a slave to this system? And then the characters could rightly say, because you made us, Kurt. This would never happen in real life. But okay, so here's the segment. Introducing Vonno. What? Very similar inflection to what you used for the last segment. But so Vonno What is where we cop to what I call the Rudyard Kipling effect, because Rudyard Kipling was my favorite poet growing up. And then I read the poem The White Man's Burden, which is about black people, and was very, very upset.
And what a pain they are.
Well, but it was about how, like, it's so misguided. He's like, stop being racist, you guys. They're really bad at everything, and they're poor and helpless. We need to help them. You should feel pity for them. It's like, we don't need that kind of help, Rudyard. Just back off, Rudyard. So Vonno What is where we talk about this sort of problematic areas, and I think we already touched on. I do think he gets better and better, and like even by the second book, Beatrice in Sirens is one of the best female characters ever.
Yeah.
And I think has a lot of self-agency.
Yeah.
But basically the female characters are Catherine, who's like your classic, super airheaded, overly hysterically emotional secretary, literally.
Yeah. And is hooking up with another like engineer
guy at the office
already.
Just casually. Yeah. Anita, his wife, who he said is Lady Macbeth, basically.
Yeah.
And I'm just gonna throw some quotes out there. Anita was armed to the teeth with jewelry. She had combined the female weapons of sex and taste with an aura of masculine competence.
Right.
So I love that he's like, all the evil parts about her, very feminine. Although that edge of like intelligence, very masculine.
Yeah. And it's so weird that so much of this book is very autobiographical about GE and his life. And then Kurt's actual wife, Jane, like he wrote her love letters for years in college and after that. And like they were like such collaborators on everything. And like they had such a wonderful, close relationship. And then his first novel, he's like, shark woman. That'll be fine.
Yeah. Well, it's clearly a bad marriage all throughout. Yeah. Right. And like Finnerty berates her for not respecting the privacy of men when she like pops her head into the office to see if they could use any refreshments or anything.
Right.
He's like, you must perfectly respect nice. The privacy of men. Keep in mind, this isn't in the 50s. This is how Vonnegut thinks it will still be in the future.
In the
That's
future.
What's weird to me. At the Meadows, and actually, tragically, I wouldn't be surprised if this still happened at like a GE-style company retreat.
Yeah.
They pay some guy every year to like dress up as a caricature of a Native American and like dance around doing Native American shit. Yeah. For all these old white men to be like, you're right, we do embody the noble spirit of the people we exterminated from this land. We are great. Like literally co-opting all the Native American culture and handing it over to the GE executives.
Right.
That scene was like rough. But I don't put that on Vonnegut because it's obviously supposed to be horrible.
Yeah.
Like he, you know, you in the book think it's awful. As
well, especially because the Finger Lakes up there in New York, that was like the seat of the Iroquois Confederation historically. And so it's like a very traditional thing. But then they're like, great, let's use that for making widgets.
But the one I want your take on, and be honest, if it occurred to you while you were reading, this is the one I really do put on Vonnegut and like the times in which he was raised or wherever you land on that art versus time you were born in argument. Yeah. The Shah of Bratpur, I think, is way too noble savage. His whole function in the story is to have these really wise one-liners. Like he sees the machine telling all the humans what to do and the humans running around and he goes, what do you call those people? Through an interpreter. And the guy's like, oh, workers or citizens, he says. They're citizens, sir, you know, because he's patriotic. And he goes, ah, Kurdishna, or whatever made up word Vonnegut did for their language. And he's like, what does that mean? Slaves. So it's like, oh, like Shah of Bratpur often ends a chapter by going like, in our country, we would use this word to describe it. And it's Vonnegut's way of going, get it? Like they're slaves.
Yeah.
He's really there to like bolster the thesis. Yet he is like a befuddled dummy who doesn't know the most rudimentary like technologies as if they haven't reached his country yet and doesn't understand a lot of like basic things going on.
Right.
And just sort of bumbles around drinking constantly
heavily.
And wondering if he can have sex with the women around.
Yeah.
Like, can I have sex with that one? Oh, no. All right. What about that one? And so I'm like, that bugged me. Or just that depiction.
I agree. And I think there's also in Brothers Vonnegut, they talk about that in real life, the Prime Minister of Pakistan visited GE and was like doing a tour of the US to like see what America is like.
So
and
this
even
is
like
impression of like
did the thing of visiting an average family home, quote unquote, because that's a scene in the Shah storyline where he visits a regular home. But Kurt went from like, oh, the leader of probably a perfectly intelligent country who would like know things. Let's make him this cartoon. That wasn't a great way to do it.
Yeah.
Especially with him drinking constantly that he didn't need to do.
Yeah, but I did like the, some klish, whatever that is.
Yeah.
I did like his made-up language.
Yeah, and apparently he drew on his, like, study of linguistics and his master's program.
They all do that.
Figure that out.
Tolkien,
but that's everybody.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was Vonna what?
Vonna what?
Vonna what?
Yeah. And that's, I think, mostly player piano. And it also, the science fiction elements of it, like when it came out, the book was not a very big hit. Like it got some relatively polite reviews and then it didn't sell particularly well. It was nominated for an International Fantasy Award in 1953, which is not an award they give out anymore. But a lot of the reviews sort of characterized it as since he's trying to do Brave New World, this is science fiction. And then from there on, there's that Kurt Vonnegut line about like, oh, the critics see the science fiction drawer as a urinal and I shouldn't be in it. This book
or
is
like,
sort
at
of
best,
how
it's
he
the
gets
bottom
there.
Drawer and some mistake it for a urinal.
Yeah. And between this and then especially Sirens when they actually leave Earth and things like that. It's really.
See, I wonder if he read Sirens when he was done and knew that it was the best book ever written. Because if so, I would be justifiably like, ah, screw you guys if it didn't do well. You know, or if anyone who didn't get it. It's kind of like Nick Drake. Apparently, his suicide note included a lot of stuff of like, it's unfair that people didn't appreciate what a musical genius I am. Screw them.
Really?
You'll all be sorry when I'm dead. And it's like, on one hand, that's very petulant and short-sighted.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, have you heard Nick Drake? He is fucking incredible.
It's really good.
And if people weren't saying it to him at the time, they should have been. Like, he is a genius. Was.
Yeah, they blew it.
They really blew it there. Could have had 3 more Nick Drake albums before he started getting shitty.
And here we go into our next segment called Related Reading.
Flip, flip, flip,
reading
read.
Books.
My eyes scan from left to right, top to bottom. That was very Eurocentric. I'm sorry.
The mechanism of it. Yeah. If you've never heard this name before, this is where we pick out amazing works by other writers that remind us of the themes or events or something else, and you might dig them.
Yeah. Automation, free will, related reading.
Yeah.
So I wanted to say another recurring theme in this podcast is I will always recommend Harlan Ellison.
Yeah.
There's a really good Harlan Ellison short story. Okay. There's four that I'm going to mention that all tie to Player Piano. A comic book series, actually, called Dream Corridor, which I think includes within it an adaptation of a short story called The Silver Corridor, where, not to spoil it, but it's sort of like a virtual reality room you go into to settle debates or business problems with the opposing side. And it literalizes your force of will. So the VR experience constantly changes and shifts, and you're always in competition with the other person, but you will do better or worse or suffer more or less based on your force of will. And whoever wins the argument in this society, it's considered like binding arbitration. Yeah. So you can do a hostile takeover of a company by like believing in your company's vision more than the other person.
Oh, crazy.
If you are in the room, and that's how it goes down. So that's one. Yeah. I don't want to give away, you know, the punchline. There's an incredible large print book called Repent, Harlequin, Said the TikTok Man. That's the name of the story. Repent, Harlequin, Said the TikTok Man.
Some of his titles, man.
But
amazing.
Specifically, I suggest you get the giant version that's like beautifully illustrated, because there's a big print version that's awesome. And that's about a society where, which has since been done as a movie, you have a limited amount of time allotted to your life, and you can trade and buy and sell how much time exists left on your lifespan.
Oh.
And there's a rebellion growing to try and stop that practice because it's fucked up.
Yeah.
And then my last one for Player Piano, my favorite and the most Vonnegutian, it's called Knox, K-N-O-X. And Ellison usually is very loquacious and like flowery. He loves long sentences with a lot of words that are not strictly necessary, but that's what I love about him. But Knox is the opposite. It's super Vonnegut-y.
Oh.
So literally the first lines are Knox, period. Knox was a man, period. Knox was a man who, period.
Oh.
Who had a mission, period. And the whole thing reads like that. It's about a dude living in a player piano society who never questions it and always believes in the society and is a patriot and is all about making sure his neighbors and everyone around him are loyal to the society at all costs.
That's amazing.
It's very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's so even, that's also very Vonnegut-y, I feel like, to have a structure where it's like the structure is very visible, you know? And it's like, oh, you can see exactly how the author was constructing it.
Yeah. Just as controlled as the society itself.
Yeah.
All right, you got Player Piano one?
Yeah, these are quick. But one is a short story by Ray Bradbury. It's one in the Illustrated Man, which is a collection of his, which also has a frame and is amazing. But it's called The Veldt, V-E-L-D-T.
Yeah.
And it's about a family that lives in a house, which is a Player Piano house. Like, they bought a package that automates everything and handles everything for them. And it's directly that, but also it's called The Veldt because there's an aspect where it can do a virtual reality thing through telepathy. And the kids are like, let's go to the African savannah, The Veldt. Let's check that out. And I won't spoil the ending of it, but it's an amazing short story and was also written right around the same year that Player Piano was. I think it was 1951. And so that is very fascinating to see a contemporary author who also, in the Kurt Vonnegut letters I was reading, they started corresponding in the late
50s. Bradbury and Vonnegut.
Bradbury and Vonnegut, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Just very exciting to me because I love them both. But that story is an amazing take on a lot of the themes in Player Piano. And the one other one is The Caves of Steel, which is a novel by Isaac Asimov. It's one of the big hitters of sci-fi. You may know it if you follow it. But it is like Player Piano in that it's about a society that has everything it needs because of technology. And Caves of Steel's case, everyone's moved underground, Caves of Steel, into huge cities. But also automation is semi-replacing jobs, except in Player Piano, it's very much just unthinking machines are so powerful that they've taken care of things and maybe we'll have AI. But Caves of Steel, it's about a human detective. He loses his partner and his new partner is a robot detective, a fully thinking, feeling robot. And
some
so
people
a lot
credit
of,
it for inspiring Blade Runner or some of the tropes of Blade Runner. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's very
bad and Neuromancer.
And good because it should
and
be a movie
good.
Or something.
Oh, yeah.
Like it, awesome. You know?
Yeah. It should definitely be a movie. And you were telling me that the Westworld creator has admitted that symbol is lifted, right?
So also, according to Vulture, Jonathan Nolan, who created or co-created Westworld, the TV show
certainly
now
directs
on HBO,
most of the episodes.
Yeah, the force behind it. He said that there's a player piano in the brothel saloon bar in Westworld, and it happens to play like player piano versions of modern songs, which is fun. But he said that was specifically inspired by Kurt Vonnegut's player piano.
Yeah.
So if you watch
that, and how
could
you not say that? I mean, that symbol is, yeah.
Right.
It's the same symbol being used in the exact same way.
Yes.
to automate music, isn't that to destroy the beauty of it?
Right. It's so
direct. We read player piano, bitch.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's enough related reading. We got a lot more to cover. Get it?
Yeah.
Reading, cover, book cover.
Literature. Let's do, so we've talked about the book. I think we can kind of wind things down. Also, I feel like this podcast can be a resource to you, the person living right now, because maybe you care about Kurt Vonnegut things going on in the world, because they're constantly those. Here's a segment for Vonnegut News.
X-ray. Vonnegut News, y'all.
There's a lot's happening in Indianapolis. There's a Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library there, and they successfully launched a Kickstarter recently. They needed 100 grand, and they got, I think, 117,000. And so they're going to move to
the horrors of automation.
Right.
That should have been a bake sale done with human hands.
So then robots are going to move them to a building, like a much larger building at more centrally in Indianapolis as soon as they can, which will be great. And then also, New York City just had a musical version of God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater at City Center.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's closed now, but it's a revival of a musical written by Howard Ashman and Alan Menken, who are most famous for doing a lot of like Disney stuff, like Little Mermaid and things like that. They did the songs for. But if anyone saw that, I'm super curious. Is it good? I don't know if God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater would be an amazing musical or not.
Well, I think the classic Menken Disney era, if you take out that they're animated, just throw that out of the equation.
Yeah.
They're some of the best musicals ever written, regardless.
Oh, absolutely.
Like they stand with Broadway musicals, of course. They're phenomenal.
Yeah, they're great. Yeah. So it was probably really good, but I'm super curious about it. And if anybody saw it, let us know.
I always wonder, though, because then at this point, this is like their 15th album. You know, some bands stick it out, but I'd be very curious to know if you're like, man, it was as good as goddamn Little Mermaid. Like, it was, you know what I mean? Like, the songs were that catchy and, like, memorable. The melodies were really stuck in your head. Or is it like, they've done better.
Late period.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so those are things going on in your world if you're into Kurt Vonnegut, and especially in Indiana.
Hoosiers. For the Hoosiers out there.
So, yeah, thank you so much for listening and talking player piano with us, in your head probably, as we talked about it here.
And it is a book club, so you might get, I mean, you don't need to, but you could get more out of it if you read our next piece, which is Sirens, is that right?
That's right. We're going chronologically. We may kind of make stops for when short story collections and things like that came out, but we're going novel by novel.
Reading Sirens of Titan, you will not be disappointed.
Yeah, especially for being only a second novel is amazing. It's really great.
Yeah. This one still had a lot of interesting stuff in it, but it does feel like we were obliged to do it before we get to like, and boom, like we're off and running, because Sirens of Titan is like, it almost feels like it's five novels later. Because in this thing, he's still kind of like, I want to fit in with the crowd. And then he's like, screw it. Sirens of Titan. This is what Vonnegut sounds like. And he pretty much sounds like that for the rest of his career. And it's amazing.
And it's so good. So thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed Player Piano. And we're taking on Sirens of Titan next. In the meantime, we are on Facebook at facebook.com/KurtVonnegut. We're on Twitter at KurtVonnegut and Instagram at KurtVonnegut. We want this to be very book clubby, and we want to talk to you about these books on the internet. In the meantime, see you next time. All right, that was fun. So we're going to be releasing a new episode of the show. Yes, we're calling it Kurt Vonnegut once a month. But you don't have to wait to listen to episode 2, because it's up right now in the Kurt Vonnegut podcast feed. So if you liked that, go search Kurt Vonnegut in iTunes or SoundCloud and subscribe. We'll link off to the iTunes and SoundCloud pages in the summary. And yeah, there are already 2 episodes up. The first one that you just listened to, minus my bullshit, and episode 2, Sirens of Titan, which is an even better book and might be a better episode,
actually. And they'll be dropping every month going forward. They want to give you and themselves time to do the reading, though, like we said, not totally necessary. And that'll do it for us this week. Thanks to engineer Brett, who you can follow at Brett, R-A-D-E-R, on Twitter. You can follow me at Jack_O'Brien. And we'll be back next week with more podcasts. Talk to you then.
Stalks your inbox while you sleep. The ear wolf. Once every fortnight, this lupine beast sneaks across the internet carrying only a newsletter featuring exciting podcast highlights, fan art, live tour dates, in-studio photos of stars like Mel Brooks and Susan Sarandon, and sneak peeks of podcasts yet to come. If you want these valuable treasures, all you have to do is invite it in by going to earwolf.com and subscribing to its email newsletter, and then wait for the earwolf to visit.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.